Well, I've made it to the last one. Apparently you guys have too. We're drawing to close this rather disparate collection of passages that basically the common theme is the difficult or passages that create a lot of questions for people. The topic for today is the problem of Old Testament morality, which I have to confess is a little bit misleading. We're not going to get very far into that. But it is an issue that has been on the list since I started this series. Wendell gave me a list of topics years ago when we started this, and that was one that was on the list of a number of different ways. What about the Old Testament morality? What about all the mistreatment of people in the Old Testament? What about the role of women? Those sorts of things. Most of the topics I get as suggestions for this series fall into the category of either being too brief to treat in a sermon, where you'd have to string a bunch of them together and just give simple answers, or they're too broad to deal with in a single sermon. And this obviously is one that fits in that second category. So I spend as much time trying to figure out how to put a topic together that's manageable within a one-shot deal, such as we have on Sunday mornings. This is not a new topic, of course. It's been around forever. The question of mistreatment of women, the death and destruction that occurs in the Old Testament, the immoral actions of Old Testament saints, all of those have been questions that have plagued Christians throughout the centuries. It's perhaps a little bit more to the forefront today because this has been a central theme of the neo-atheists, the new atheists, who make a big deal of this. Not particularly well, of course, in their treatment of it. They simply gather together a few examples without any critical understanding of what the passages are in context or what the narrative of the story is overall. So you get people like Richard Dawkins, who has what apparently is a third-grade exposure to the Bible, stringing together a bunch of these instances that are not at all the same sort of thing. It's a jumbled category of different things. And he shows no discernment as to what the context of the original story is, whether it was approved by God, or whether it was something that the Old Testament commands, or whether it's just something that occurred. So this has been, again, one of their main bulkheads in the attack against Christianity. And virtually all of the new atheists have drawn heavily on this. And their expectation is, of course, that the average person reading this will be horrified by these examples, and they won't know enough to respond and give any kind of context to the discussion at all. So part of this does involve serious difficulties in understanding some of these passages, some of the culture of the ancient Near East. But a lot of it deals with our ignorance of the Old Testament and how we understand and interpret the Old Testament. So when I started the passage for this week, a few months back, I was going to address the wider issue. Then I decided I would deal just with the treatment of women in the Old Testament. And finally I realized both of those are way too big to do in a single session. So I thought I would establish or at least present some principles that deal with Old Testament interpretation in these areas that will then be the basis on which you could have further discussion and thought on these passages. So perhaps we'll be able to continue looking at specific passages in future sermons, or perhaps some books that I suggest today might be something that you'd pursue on your own. But when we look at the Old Testament, even as Christians, frankly, it seems, you know, it's ancient, foreign, and somewhat bizarre to our understanding as well. There's no getting around it. And in fact, this sort of thing led to heretics throughout the history of the church to sort of write off the Old Testament, try and get rid of it. Think of the Gnostics who totally dispense with the Old Testament. Also, you have sects within Christianity that virtually ignore the Old Testament when they develop their theology. They focus entirely on the New Testament. And a lot of times in churches, you know, we treat the Old Testament stories as if they're sort of pious morality tales for Sunday school and for kids, and beyond that, we don't gather much. So it's important that we have a better understanding, a little more nuanced understanding of what we're dealing with when we deal with these issues in the Old Testament. And as I said today, we're only going to touch on some real broad categories with a few minor illustrations, but it's important that we have some sort of understanding that goes beyond just picking it up and sort of drawing our own conclusion. So we need to be reminded of these sorts of things, and some will be obvious to you, and some will be perhaps things you haven't given much thought to. So we're going to deal with eight principles to remember when working with the Old Testament. Number one, we talked about this in the series this time as well, reporting is not endorsing. It's very important. People, again, look at the way the new atheists teach this. They pull a story out and say, oh, look, this is the sort of thing God demands. It's not the sort of thing God demands at all. It's a record of something that happened. In some cases, it's condemned. You know, the illustrations they use, if they'd read a little further, they would see that the action was condemned by God. But in other cases, it's a narrative that within the context is meant to be indicative of God's disapproval. Overall, when we deal with narratives in the Old Testament, narratives, of course, tell us what happened. It's a record of history. Sometimes this includes a formal evaluation of what God thinks of it, but most cases in the Old Testament, it does not. It's a story that, again, is to be seen in context of the overall narrative of the Old Testament. And one of the biggest errors, again, of the new atheists is that they tend to raid these stories and treat them as if they're all the same thing and they're all approved by God. So we looked earlier about Jephthah and the idea that this is not an approved thing, it's something that happened. That's precisely the sort of thing we're talking about here. You've got to understand the overall context of the Old Testament. You've got to understand the specific context of the story. And you've got to remember that the simple recording of it does not mean it's endorsed. Again, that's obvious to everybody, but it's amazing how many Christians don't think of that when they read the Old Testament. They simply sort of seem to assume that everything in there is somehow endorsed by God. Second principle, you need to understand Old Testament literary genres. Again, we don't talk a lot about this. We, again, tend to hand people a Bible and say, go to it, you'll be able to understand it. But there are different types of literature in the Old Testament, and just as we read different types of literature in our own culture in different ways, you have to do that when it comes to the Old Testament. A lot of you have been through hermeneutics. You know that this is one of the standard principles there, but it's good to be reminded of that. You have to consider, what type of literature is this? How should I take this? Should I take it as a truth statement? Should I take it as a narrative? Should I take it as figurative speech? What should I do with it? Obvious examples that we've talked about, again, in hermeneutics, you know, proverbs are not meant to be absolute promises. And it's amazing how many Christians take it that way. They pull a proverb out and say, oh, this is a promise God has made. It's meant to be a generalization. It's just like our own proverbs, you know. And because they're generalizations and not absolutely true, we have to be careful how we apply them. So when it says, you know, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart, that's not an absolute promise that if you do that, he's going to turn out right. What it is saying, the general principle here is that you've got to train a child correctly, and the chances are he's going to remain in it. But it's not an absolute promise. So you get all sorts of crazy things that flow out of that. You just have to be careful with that. Proverbs are generalizations. They're not universally true. They're generally true. And again, it's no different than our own proverbs. You know, we have look before you leap. At the same time, we have things like a stitch in time saves nine. You know, do you think ahead of time, or do you, you know, he who hesitates is lost. You know, do you not? All of these things are just, again, generalizations. Poetry. We look at poetry, and it's amazing, again, how many cults have drawn their doctrine from statements in the poetic books. Because it uses figurative language, it's not as tightly argued and reasoned, you can make it say a lot of different things. And therefore, it is something that is standard among groups that have aberrant theology, to build their doctrine out of poetic. Poetry is an expression of thoughts, feelings, emotions, impressions, those sorts of things. It's not meant to be like a textbook. So when in Psalms 137 it talks about desiring infants' heads to be dashed against the rocks, it's not meant to be an endorsement of that sort of behavior. It's this person's emotional response to the oppression from the Babylonians that's going on. You got to be, again, careful and don't read, you know, like a second grader would. You know, have some nuanced understanding of the type of language we're dealing with here. And narratives are probably the one that get used incorrectly the most. We're not used to thinking of theology in terms of narratives. We're used to thinking theology in terms of tightly reasoned syllogisms and straightforward teaching. So to get our theology from a story becomes a little more difficult for us because we don't think in those terms. Oscar Palmer Robertson, the great Old Testament scholar, said, "Theological truth is embedded in a historical narrative rather than in generalized propositions." So it's again the idea that these stories have theological truth in them, but you have to read them with a discerning eye to distinguish what's being taught. You can't just take it as a nice story and move on to the next one. There are clues and indicators embedded within the tenor of the text, the details that are included or left out of a text. You've got to be discerning as to what's going on there. Is there a subtle hint that this is a disapproved action? Are there subtle hints here that there's a blessing involved from God? The narrator in these passages rarely censure or approve explicitly. They don't come out and say God didn't like this or God does like this, but rather the author guides the reader towards a correct moral judgment by inference. What's inferred here? What's the general structure of the narration? Where is it headed? You could think about this in terms of the Old Testament, the problem of polygamy. You know, it doesn't specifically condemn polygamy out and out. However, there's a number of things in the text that would lead us to believe that this is not a correct understanding. It's not God's moral ideal. If you think in terms of the establishment of marriage in Genesis, first three chapters of Genesis, it's set forward in terms of one man, one woman. It's quite clear. And those are the principles that tend to be drawn on when there's teaching on marriage throughout, not just the Old Testament, but the New as well. The commands about marriage throughout the Old Testament law are always put in terms of wife, not wives. Again, that's not an explicit thing. That's an inference that you have to make from the text. Everywhere these principles are set forward, it talks about wife rather than wives. When it gives advice about marriage, it's in the singular as well. Think of Malachi 2:15. Do not be unfaithful to the wife of your youth. Or Proverbs 5:18. May you rejoice in the wife of your youth. Ecclesiastes 9:9. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of your life. All those that are giving moral instruction about marriage are set in terms of one man, one woman. Polygamy, introduced in the Bible by Lamech in Genesis 4. And it's interesting the context. He's the first one that's mentioned he had two wives. And it's done in a tracing of the line of Cain, which then is contrasted in the next chapter with the tracing of the godly line of Seth. And so in this context, it actually pauses at Lamech, who's the seventh in the line, and sort of presents his character as one who's boastful and arrogant and sets himself up as his own law and talks about him having two wives. If you follow through in the line with Seth, the seventh one is also a pause where they make editorial comments, and the seventh one there is Enoch, who was translated to heaven, who's a godly man. And those two are set as a subtle contrast. When you're following the line, you get to number seven, which is, you know, the number of completion. For the Canaanite line, it's this polygamous man who's arrogant and rebellious against God, who boasts for being in the line of Cain. And it's contrasted with this godly man who's translated by God because of his closeness to God. If you look at the genealogy in that section, it's just pretty overwhelming to see that he's tracing two separate lines, which is the story that establishes the narrative throughout Genesis, that there's two types of two lines of human life, those that are in rebellion against God and those that aren't. Just a little bit down, if you look at the mixed line that's talked about in Genesis 6, you know, the sons of God and the daughters of men. If you take that, as I do, to indicate that we're talking here about those same two lines intermixing, then it's quite interesting that what's said about there in verse 2, in the NIV it says they married any of them they chose, speaking of the women from the godly line. But Old Testament translators such as David Klein would argue that verse 2 should be better translated, taking for themselves as many women as they choose. Again, emphasizing that this ungodly line's pattern is to be involved in polygamy. There are subtle clues in some of the stories in Genesis as well. If you look at the story of Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai before their covenant, it's clear in the Old Testament that a concubine can also be considered as a secondary wife. You see this in the case of Abraham marrying Keturah after the death of Sarah. Later in the Bible, she's called his concubine, even though it's clear that she is his wife. But nowhere in the Bible is Hagar ever referred to, or God ever referred to Hagar as Abraham's wife. When he talks to her, it's always in terms of Hagar, the slave of Sarah, or, you know, it's always the mistress or slave or the servant. It's never considered wife. When God addresses Hagar, he doesn't say, return to your husband, Abraham, but return to your mistress. Again, subtle clues that this is not considered to be a normal godly relationship. Throughout the rest of the Old Testament, the history of polygamy is presented as one that's cause of trouble and distress. You know, think of David and Solomon and their marriages and all the problems and the eventual destruction of the kingdom that comes from that. Richard Davidson, who has written extensively in this area, says, although these biblical narratives, he's talking about the narratives of plural marriage, provide no explicit verbal condemnation of this practice, the narrator presents each account in such a way as to underscore a theology of disapproval. The record of these polygamous relationships bristle with discord, rivalry, heartache, and even rebellion, revealing the motivations and are the disastrous consequences that invariably accompany such departures from God's Edenic ideal. Here as elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, a narrative theology of divine disapproval often speaks louder and more eloquently than explicit condemnation. Principle number 3, remember the overall narrative of the Old Testament. Again, we often think of it as nice pietistic stories that have moral lessons. But in fact, there's an overall narrative that runs throughout the Old Testament. There's a blessing from God, there's man's rebellion, there's judgment for his rebellion, there's repentance, and then it repeats, and it repeats. You know, much of the history of the Old Testament can be found in the blessings and cursings in Deuteronomy. You know, when the people draw close to God, there's blessings, when they go away, there's judgment. So again, there's no absolute endorsement of everything that goes on. Indeed, there's illustrations of when man pulls away, and there's illustrations of when man gets restored to relationship with God. To forget that and to just indiscriminately take a passage and somehow assign value to it is to ignore the overall context. And that overall narrative is very important. You've got to keep that in mind throughout your reading of the Old Testament. Number 4, you need to develop a more nuanced understanding of the Old Testament law, the Pentateuch. The law, in many cases, is meant to contain fallen human behavior. It's not always a reflection of perfection. regulation is not the same thing as approval. You know, you think about this, the idea of there being regulations about how to handle slaves doesn't mean there's approval of slavery, only the recognition that in that culture and day there's going to be slavery and to put some moral restrictions on it. This is no more an endorsement than those laws against theft endorse theft. You know, if somebody steals something, this is to happen. It's not an endorsement of theft any more than if you have a slave, you have to treat him such and such a way, endorses slavery. Much of the Old Testament law, beyond the Ten Commandments, is case law. It's meant to apply to specific defined conditions. You've got to be careful then of translating that into broader application. It's a lot like modern law. You know, you've got all sorts of different rules, and this one applies in this situation, but it might be modified by this law over here. You've got to read it with some nuance and understanding. It has particular parameters that this case deals with. So you don't get a full picture by reading one verse and pulling out of context and making a generalization about it. Just like modern law, it's complicated. And its seeming contradiction is it goes away when you look closer in many cases. So for example, there are well over a dozen different crimes that death is prescribed in the Deuteronomic law. In one of those specific cases, it says, and this is the case that deals with premeditated murder that's been proven, you're not to allow a ransom. The person has to be put to death. The fact that that clause is in there indicates that there are other cases apparently where death penalty can be commuted by a ransom or a substitute. So, you know, you got to read with a more nuanced understanding. You've got to read the whole thing and sort of figure out how all of these parts come together. You can think of the Old Testament Lex Talionis idea, the idea of eye for an eye. You know, reading that in our culture today, it looks pretty strange, you know. You can just sort of extract equal damage. But in fact, it's meant to mediate those sort of feuds between clans. Somebody would have something wrong done to them, and the other person would just go out and utterly destroy as many people in the other clan as they could. The idea here is that punishment is to be proportional, or compensation is to be proportional. So it's meant to be restrictive and more humane rather than, again, reading it today, we think in terms of, wow, you can go out and, you know, chop the other guy's hand off because you lost a hand. That's not nearly what the full picture of that law is. Number five, you've got to avoid reading your own culture into the text. We do this all the time. We tend to read stories about life in ancient times, and we tend to sort of read it in the context of our own lives. We do this a lot with home and family life. We tend to think of Abraham and Sarah out there in the desert and sort of an Ozzie and Harriet-like existence. I just lost most of the audience. Most people don't know who Ozzie and Harriet. It's danger of getting old. But we're dealing, in the case of Abraham and Sarah, with nomadic desert life thousands of years ago. It hardly looks like a 1950s American family. You know, the stereotype in the 1950s of a wife who's barefoot pregnant in the kitchen doesn't apply in this situation. This was a nomadic family that was well off. They had servants. In most cases, at mealtime, you didn't all get together and, you know, sing kumbaya and have a nice meal together. Generally, the men were fed first. The women and children then ate at a later time in a separate seating altogether. We can't just automatically sort of read back our own stuff. You've got to stop and think, what would a family life have looked like back then, and not just assume it looks like ours today? You know, the education in many families was turned over to a faithful slave or servant they had. You know, again, that sort of runs counter to our idea, but in fact, again, you've got to think, what was the context there historically and culturally? We sometimes read Proverbs 31 with a too much prejudiced eye as well. Proverbs 31 doesn't deal just with the woman sitting around the house all day cleaning and cooking. She's out doing industry. She's out buying a field and seeing that it gets planted so it can produce a wine, those sorts of things. We tend to read it, again, in a very narrow thing and think of it in terms of our own culture and our own understanding of what an ideal family situation would be. Women in the Old Testament have a much wider role than what we usually assign to them. You know, and archaeologically, for example, we found seals from town councils in the ancient world that actually have women on the seal. They're women involved with ruling of the town council. Again, we can't draw wide conclusions one way or the other. We have to look at the story and analyze it from the context. Number six, we've got to avoid naive stereotypes of biblical culture. It goes right along with the one we just said. It's clear that the ancient world was a patriarchal world, but it doesn't mean everything that we necessarily assign to it today. You know, again, thinking back to another golden oldie that most of you won't know, but the old Ralph Cramden show, The Honeymooners. You know, he was the king of his castle, and everybody was there to serve him. A lot of people have that idea about Christian family relationships today. That's not the case. It's not the sort of patriarchy that many of the critics of the Bible have, or that many fundamentalists think of. And we'll see some of those examples in the next category as well. Know something of other contemporary ancient Near Eastern cultures. There's a place in one of C.S. Lewis's works where he talks about people saying, oh, look at that crotchety old guy there, he claims to be a Christian, you know, what's the deal there? And Lewis's answer is, well, yeah, you have to think about where he was before he became a believer. Maybe he's moved much further than you have in his progress. You know, it's sort of like that with looking at the culture of the ancient Jews. If you compare it with what's going on in the other ancient Near Eastern cultures, there's a lot of parallels, but there's very significant and important distinctions as well. And in fact, if you take something like the role of women, it's elevated in Hebrew culture over the other ancient Near Eastern cultures. So people often, again, point to specific things in the Old Testament and say, oh, look, women are being denigrated there. Not necessarily the case. You know, people draw the conclusion that because passages such as Deuteronomy 5:21, which says, if I can find it here, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, you shall not set your desire in your neighbor's house or land, his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. They argue that because the wife is lumped in there with all the possessions of the household, women must be property in the Old Testament. That's not the case. This passage is dealing with the household as a whole, the things that the man has the protectorate over, he's responsible for in a legal sense. And so it's not meant to identify the wife and the servants as people with other property. And particularly in the case of the wife. You know, there's no selling of wives in the Old Testament. You can sell a slave. In that sense, slavery is property, or the slaves are property, but a wife is in a totally different category. The fact that they're listed all together here does not mean that the conclusion you're drawing from that is the right conclusion. The conclusion has to do with all the things within a household that could be coveted by someone else. It doesn't have to deal with the question of property. If you look at other ancient Near Eastern laws, wife and children can be taken away as punishment. So the government has something against you, they can take your wife and children away. They are treated as property. You don't have that in the Old Testament. Sometimes critics point to bride prices and say, look, isn't that the husband just buying a wife? Well, again, it's a failure to understand the cultural context that we're dealing with. The bride price is given to the bride's father as a demonstration of financial responsibility and of the fact that the father will be deprived of the work of the daughter. But the father's giving of a dowry exceeds usually the bride's price back. And that's given as a way of guaranteeing the safety and protection of his wife. It becomes a financial thing that can be drawn upon by the new family. But should anything ever happen that the husband mistreats the wife and there's a split in the marriage, she's protected because that dowry goes back with her as long as she's not the one that violated the marriage covenant. So it's meant, again, as a protection. It's not meant in the sense of, oh, I'm going to go out and spend money and then I get a woman that I can do whatever I want with. That's not the case at all. We know this and further by looking at the marriage contracts in the ancient world. When you go in Israel, there's all sorts of interesting things. When they got married, it wasn't just a matter of we exchanged money or goats and now you're entirely in the possession of your husband as property. Quite the contrary, marriage contracts spell out in detail the things that the husband has to provide for the wife, the things the wife has to provide for the husband, and it's agreed upon by parties and signed as a mutual agreement. It's carefully defined. It's quite remarkable the detail at which they go, how much money is going to be spent each year in clothing for the wife, those sorts of things. It's not, again, the sort of thing where the wife just signs on and she's totally at the disposal of whatever her husband wants to do. If that marriage contract is violated, that's grounds for ending the marriage. And it's costly to the husband involved. So, again, we tend to think of these things in a rather naive way and need to be more informed about it. Other ancient Near Eastern laws, if your wife does something wrong, there are laws that demand that you beat her or whip her, can mutilate her ears in some of the cultures, pluck out her hair. I mean, there's all sorts of things prescribed in ancient Near Eastern laws in the countries around Israel. The Bible doesn't actually command or even give permission for the husband to punish the wife in any way. You know, that's remarkable when you consider, again, all the nations around at the time. The portrayals we sometimes get of people, again, is jaded by our thinking. If you think in terms of the idea that the husband's the master of the household, and he's ultimate authority and can command whatever he wants, doesn't seem to fit the portrayals of marriage life of the saints in the Old Testament. I mean, very interesting stuff when you look at Abraham's life, when you think of it in detail, what's being said here, what's being portrayed here. You don't find Abraham running around commanding his wife to do things. In a lot of the cases, he goes to her and asks her. I mean, even that lame brain scheme he has to pass off his wife as his sister so that the Egyptians won't kill either of them. He doesn't tell her to do this, which is sort of what we'd expect from our view of what marriage was like in the ancient world. He actually goes and pleads with her. You got to do this. This is the only way we're going to be safe. He not only asks, but he pleads. There's virtually no record of any commands that Abraham gives his wife. In fact, in the context of the story, he generally does what his wife asks him. Very interesting. In the argument they have over what to do with Hagar, God takes Sarah's side and tells Abram, do as she says. You know, again, hardly the portrayal we often think of. At the covenantal name change that occurs Abram to Abraham, there's also the similar one with Sarah, Sarai to Sarah. So she gets a covenantal name change also. It's not just the husband determining the future. She's involved in this as well. And she gets a distinct covenantal promise just like Abraham. It says, Sarah shall give rise to nations, kings of people shall come to her. That same sort of general, you're going to be a blessing to the world. You're going to have many offspring and it'll be a blessing to the world. Also a real interesting one is in Genesis 18:6-8, remember the heavenly visitors that come when they approach. Both Abraham and Sarah bustle around trying to prepare food for them. You know, Sarah sent off to start baking bread, and Abraham's running around getting the meat, and he's running around getting the curds and the milk, and he's serving it to him, and he's not joining in the meal. He's not sitting down with the guys while his little woman, you know, serves them. He's standing around serving them. He doesn't sit down with them. again, a far cry from the sort of thing we generally think about. Those discussions in the Old Testament are much more nuanced than what we think of. And again, we've been cultured to think of those relationships in a certain way, but there's much more give and take than what we think of. Finally, the last one seems obvious, but this has to deal more with the suggestion of the critics that the morality of judgment decrees in the Old Testament, wipe out the Amalekites or wipe out the nations that you're going to dispossess, those sorts of things, are somehow immoral. But in the Christian premise, there is a righteous, loving, all-knowing God who makes the moral decision that judgment must come on those people. And that's something, again, we easily forget. And you would expect our critics not to draw on that. But what you have to say to them is, look, when it comes to a deal like that, first of all, we have to see if that sort of thing is meant to be taken literally. If you're still thinking about that issue, go back and listen to the series that Nate and Wendell gave on this. But even given the fact that there is some radical judgment of extermination of people or near extermination of people, on the basis of Christianity being true, there is a God overall who can make that choice. We couldn't, but he can. And so the question becomes whether there's justification for believing that that God is really there and exists. And it throws it into a different sort of apologetic question. If that's true, then our premise makes sense. And given that premise, the narrative makes sense. Now, again, we just scratched the surface on this today. There's a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, individual passages that have special circumstances. I'd just like to recommend the book by Paul Copan. He's coming to do our Reason for Hope conference next year. But one of his books is entitled, Is God a Moral Monster? That deals with these various questions. It's a good introduction to it. He doesn't get real in-depth, but it's a good introduction to the topic. When it comes to the issue of women's role in terms of whether they're subjugated or elevated in the Old Testament, there's a great book by Richard Davidson called The Flame of Yahweh, which has great material. And again, it's not that we agree totally with both of these writers, but these writers have a lot of insight into how to deal with this specific problem.